You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Wisconsin was a tipping point state in the last two presidential elections and we're likely to be one again in 2024. We talk about what a tipping point state is and why it's so crucial to presidential elections ahead here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Nashville-based trucking company Yellow abruptly shut down operations earlier this week and is headed for a bankruptcy filing. This comes after years of financial problems, which is according to a recent report from the Congressional Oversight Commission. The shutdown means more than 30,000 people are suddenly out of work. And labor organizers say that this mass layoff points to broader issues that truckers face. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been affected by the Yellow shutdown? Maybe you're a truck driver, or you used to be, or you want to be. What are the biggest issues you see facing people in that job? You can join in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ann Bailey is a writer, activist, and labor organizer. She's a former long-haul truck driver and author of the book Semi-Queer, Inside the World of Gay, Trans, and Black Truck Drivers. She's our guest now. Ann, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Yellow was one of the largest trucking companies in the country. Put this into some context for us. How does it fit into the larger matrix of the trucking industry?
Well, most truck drivers drive for mega carriers such as Yellow. So they are independent contractors or employed by these mega carriers, and they don't own the truck. They drive the freight that the company tells them to and are paid by the mile in order to deliver the freight that we get everywhere. Yellow is one of the, maybe 10 huge mega carriers that dominate the freight industry.
And Yellow was a less than truckload carrier. What does that mean?
LTL is the type of freight where you're not delivering the entire content of your trailer. So in a semi-truck that's a tractor trailer, the tractor is the part with the engine that you, sit in. And then it attaches via a fifth wheel to a trailer. And in LTL, what's in the trailer is split between deliveries. So you don't take the whole trailer to a place, which is called drop and hook, taking the trailer to one place and leaving it to be unloaded later. Instead, you take it to a place, some of it is unloaded, and then you take it to another place and some of it is unloaded. So it's just sort of, if you have enough stuff but not enough stuff to fill the entire trailer, then you hire someone who does LTL freight delivery.
If we nationwide don't have as many LTL, less than truckload carriers, what ripple effects could you see coming from this?
Well, truckers deliver everything that we eat, wear, do every single day, right? So if there are less LTL carriers than usual, there could be shortages of any of the things that we expect just to sort of automatically appear on store shelves. And one of the things that truckers care about is that we, the general public, notice and think about how stuff gets there and, depriving all of these people of their jobs also deprives us of the convenience of having stuff just easily and automatically where we expect it to be.
In Wisconsin, sometimes we have that conversation about food and farms or like milk coming from not the store, but from actual dairy farms. And you're saying, yeah, but to get from the dairy farm to the store, it's probably going on a truck.
Right. Yeah. When I was a semi driver, I was with a company based out of Appleton, Wisconsin, Rail Trucking. And we frequently delivered to, Meijer or Menards or any of these. It starts at a farm, but then it needs to be put on a truck and taken to a distribution center or a warehouse or a big box store. And then that's how we get it.
Yeah. And we don't always see that. Ann Bailey is a writer and an activist and a labor organizer, also an author and a former long-haul truck driver. And we're taking your calls about trucking here on the Ideas Network. You can use the number 800-642-1234. And we've got John in Oconomowoc ready to talk with us. Hey, John. We actually lost John. So, John, if you want to give us a call back, that's great. Or if you have experiences related to yellow or beyond that when it comes to trucking, or you have a question about the trucking industry, we might be able to tackle it now. The number again is 800-642-1234. And the Teamsters Union, which represents Yellow's 22,000 unionized workers, said that the news about Yellow shutting down was unfortunate but not surprising. Who are the Teamsters? They're mentioned all over these articles. Help us understand their role in trucking.
Well, the Teamsters was traditionally the union that dominated trucking and still, as you said, organized Yellow, but very little truck driving work is now organized by any union. So it used to be about 85% of truck drivers were in a union, and now about 18% are in a union. So the Teamsters was hoping that the Yellow contract and the UPS contract, both were up right around now, would signal a shift in organizing freight movement. And maybe that happened with UPS. I haven't seen the contract because it isn't voted yet. But with Yellow, it didn't. With Yellow, as you know, instead of getting a decent contract, the company declared bankruptcy and just fired everyone. So that's not what you hope for from a union. And as a union organizer now, I can say that in an industry with 18% coverage, a union can't do a lot. I mean, I would love to blame the Teamsters, but it's really hard to compete with unorganized workers who bottom in terms of freight shipment charges. So truck drivers don't make hardly any money compared to what they used to. It used to be a route to middle class life, and now it's a very much less pay for the amount of work that you do, and with fewer and fewer trucking companies unionized, that becomes even more true, and it's hard, that small a percent, you know, 18%, to make a difference in the industry. So trucking as a job pays less than it did before, and very few workers are in unions.
You mentioned early on, too, the idea of being paid by the mile. What happens when your truck is broken down or you're stuck in a traffic jam if you're paid by the mile?
You don't get paid, right? So there are very few industries in the U.S. now that are piecework pay models. So, you know, it used to be standard, like think about Victorian seamstresses being paid per, you know, lace collar or whatever. And that was made illegal, and instead we got an hourly wage, right, minimum wage. But the Department of Labor does not control either trucking or firm. Those are both controlled by other
And I'm going to go ahead and jump in here. I'd love to get back to the rest of your question, but we are having some trouble hearing you. So we're going to make sure that our connection is solid here. And I'll go ahead and remind our listeners that now is a time that they can be part of this conversation. We can call 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join us on the phone. We've also posted this story to the Ideas Network Facebook page, so you're able to weigh in on that. And also, you can email ideas at WPR.org. We can go ahead and talk to Steve in Johnson Creek now. Hey, Steve, what did you want to share as we're talking about trucking?
Well, let's say that... I quit counting after 40 years of trucking. I started in the 70s. I actually started driving before I even had a driver's license, which
Steve.
Don't tell the DOT. But my concern with Paul is that the safety people in cars aren't really told the safety around semi-trucks. They, granted, everybody tells them how unsafe they are and all this other kind of stuff, but it's
All right, Steve, I think we're having some connection problems to you, too. But Steve brings up the issue of safety when it comes to driving trucks. And Ann Bailey, I think we've got our connection sorted out. What do you see when you're thinking about safety and truck drivers?
Truck driving is a really dangerous job. It's one of the most dangerous jobs there is. And The government wants us to believe that regulations are to encourage safety, but that isn't, in fact, the situation. There are so many regulations now directed at drivers rather than at companies that the job becomes increasingly unsafe. If you look at crash statistics for truckers, you can see they go up every year, even as the government clamps down with more and more regulations. So the regulations are about managing workers, not about safety. But the caller is right that four-wheeler people, people who drive regular vehicles, don't consider the safety of truckers the way that they should. Like, we should be taught how to drive around trucks so that the trucker is protected, at least to the extent that is possible, out on the road. And that's not currently the situation. Like, never pull into the gap that truckers leave in front of them on the highway. They left that on purpose so they can stop. It takes a long time to stop. And frequently, you know, vehicles see that and rush into it, and that puts them and the trucker at risk.
I wonder, is it just the size difference, the physical difference, where people figure, well, they're in a big tractor and I'm in a car, they must inherently be safer? Or where do you think that comes from when you say that people driving those four-wheeled vehicles don't think about trucker safety?
Well, I mean, trucking is a stigmatized job, and truckers are considered, in many cases, just not valuable. So there isn't a system in place that values and respects what truckers do or have. So, you know this because truck stops and truck parking are being reduced, and nobody wants truck parking to open in their neighborhood. They want it to be somewhere else, anywhere else. And that's because there's a feeling that truckers are disreputable, unclean. There isn't a sense that we all depend on their labor all the time, and we should make choices that value and respect them. And so that's part of it, right? But also, even though they're big, trucks don't have airbags. There isn't anything technical in the truck that keeps the driver safe. So just being aware of that is important as well.
Ann Bailey is a labor organizer with the Service Employees International Union. We're talking about the state of trucking, the working conditions for drivers, and that's especially in the wake of trucking company Yellow ceasing operations earlier this week. Lines are open. You can give us a call and join this conversation at 800-642-1234. We just heard Ann tell us the assumptions about truckers that we know aren't true. Next up, we'll get into what truck drivers really look like and the lives they really lead. This conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with author and labor organizer Ann Bailey about the state of the trucking industry. And Ann, you wrote a book. That book is called Semi-Queer: Inside the World of Gay, Trans, and Black Truck Drivers. So tell us, who are the people that are driving trucks across our country?
That's a rapidly changing question. So people's stereotype is that a trucker is a white man, maybe middle-aged, maybe overweight. This is not true. It was true at one point when trucking paid well and offered independence and some degree of respect. But as the industry changes, those people flee it in search of other jobs that they can get. And the people who flood the industry are women, queer people, trans women, immigrants, people of color, all the people who have trouble getting more traditional or more respected jobs. And that change is fairly dramatic in the trucking industry. So if you go to any truck stop anywhere and look around, you won't see, you know, the trucker that you saw in 1970s movies about trucking. You'll see a whole mix of all kinds of people out there. It's great.
You serve on the Women of Trucking Advisory Board. What's it like for women in this profession?
There aren't very many women. There are no statistics on how many trans people drive trucks. So that's complicated and something we need to change. But it's a dangerous job for women. That's true of any male-dominated industry. It's challenging. The industry doesn't make it easy. At the same time, the women who do it absolutely love it. They love the freedom. They love movement. They love being able to shape their own lives and jobs. I mean, I met so many women who consider it like the answer to everything, that they get to do trucking. And, you know, they hate it when I emphasize the dangers. They want me also to emphasize the adventure and the excitement of it.
Well, I do have to ask, what are those dangers?
Oh, rape is really common. Almost every woman I've met who drives truck has been raped or attempted raped. It's very common. And in training fleets, the model is set up to, if not encourage, at least permit people who've been accused of rape, and in some cases convicted of rape, to continue to train new drivers, which means they're locked in a cab with each other for 6 weeks or so, with one person in complete power over the other in terms of job security. So there are problems.
It's not. Thank you for detailing that for us. Ann Bailey's an activist, a labor organizer, a writer, also a former long-haul truck driver. And we're taking your calls here on the Ideas Network. And we've got Judith in Solon Springs who'd like to join this conversation. Hi, Judith.
Hi, thank you. My husband drove long-haul trucking for 10 years, and I used to go with him on occasion. And it was very interesting to go into cities and towns where they really did not want the truckers in town. And many times we were actually told, get in and get out as fast as you can because they don't like you here. And it would just kind of surprise me, because where did they think they were getting their supplies from and their products and their whatever? It's the truckers that are bringing them in. But also I was always astounded by how the average driver on the road doesn't understand that truck is carrying thousands of pounds of weight and can't stop and can't maneuver like a car can. And the risks that drivers of cars would take just blew me away. And in fact, one time my husband, I wasn't with him this time, but he was driving and somebody was following him too close. And when he stopped, they stopped quickly and actually went down under his back bumper and got caught on his bumper, and he was dragging that car. And he didn't know that, because when you have that great big trailer behind you and all that weight, he had no clue that he was dragging that car behind him until another trucker, this was back in the day of CBs, and another trucker got him online and said, you need to pull over because you're pulling a car stuck on your bumper behind you.
Wow. Judith, thank you so much for sharing that with us as a really incredible demonstration of what we're talking about when it comes to safety. We want to go to Neil in Minnesota now, too, who's also wanting to join the conversation about safety. Hey, Neil.
Hi, good afternoon. Great conversation, great topic, you know, but I do want to, I think it's important to stress that there are safe truck drivers and there are truck drivers out there that probably could be driving safer. Same with the average public. I work in the transportation industry. I used to drive semi years ago. I don't anymore, but I still work on the highways, and I see it every day from both the truck drivers and the traveling public. From driving too fast or too too fast for conditions, tailgating, driving too close. That's something that everybody can have a part to improve on. One of the things that they've changed over the last couple of years, and I think it was February of 21 or 22, I can't remember, but they changed the CDL training requirements. You know, it used to be that you could go out and take a written test for a permit, jump in your buddy's semi and practice, and then go down, and if you were good enough, pass a written test. That's no longer the case. You have to go through an accredited training program, which is great. I think there's a lot of people out there that probably took some shortcuts getting their license. I think that's coming to an end. But there's still room for improvement. Health cards, for instance, a commercial operator has to every 2 years go and get a health card, go to see a doctor, make sure that they're fit. you know, there's a lot of organizations out there, a lot of government agencies that are exempt from those health cards, yet they're driving the same equipment, the same heavy 80,000-pound, 60,000-pound vehicle.
Yeah, Neil, thank you so much. I want to make sure that Ann has a chance to respond because, Ann, we've got a lot of focus here on safety. And in this last bit of time we have with you, I wanted to know what, you know, what remains, what do you need to get across to people about safety for truck drivers and alongside them?
If truckers were paid more, they could drive in a safer manner, right? So when we talked about construction or by the mile pay, what that doesn't acknowledge is in order to support yourself, you need to drive under conditions that maybe you wouldn't choose to if you were emphasizing only your safety. And you have to in order to make enough money to support yourself. So if you don't make money when it's snowing or if there's traffic or an accident, in order to, you know, come clean at the end of the day, you have to keep going when you might be tired. And that just means all we have to do as a country is pay attention, value truckers as professional workers, and pay more so that you're not put under this pressure because of the wage structure to keep driving when you probably shouldn't. Because you're right, caller, that most truckers are safe drivers who really want to do a good job and have no desire to die at work, but are often put under really intense pressure to keep driving when they shouldn't. Mm.
And this has been a really informative conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about this.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Ann Bailey, former long-haul truck driver herself. She's currently an organizer with the Service Employees International Union. She wrote the book Semi-Queer: Inside the World of Gay, Trans, and Black Truck Drivers, and joined us for a closer look at what's going on in the trucking industry after major freight company Yellow ceased operations earlier this week. Coming up here on the Ideas Network, tomorrow on the morning show, we're strategizing on staycations. Not everyone has the money or even the time to travel around the world for vacation, so join us to hear from a travel coach and a psychology professor. We'll talk about how to make the most of a staycation. That's tomorrow morning on the morning show. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight at 6 o'clock on 1A Plus, a conversation with the Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr. He talks to Jen White about the new national monument to his cousin and best friend, Emmett Till. They also talk about how best to teach Black history. That's at 6 o'clock on 1A Plus. Now on Central Time, let's talk about tipping point states and why they're so important in presidential elections. A tipping point state is mathematically indispensable to winning a presidential election. Wisconsin was one in 2016 and in 2020, and analysts expect that it will be once again in the upcoming election. We want to hear from you on this. You can call 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about tipping point states and the way that votes are counted? As a voter in a battleground state, do you feel like your vote is more important? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Craig Gilbert. Craig is the Lubar Fellow at Marquette University Law School and recently retired Washington Bureau Chief and National Political Reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's covered every presidential campaign since 1988. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
A tipping point state is not the same thing as a battleground state, right?
Well, it's you know, in all likelihood, a battleground state, but it's not necessarily the closest state in a given election. I mean, the way I would explain this is if you look at how Wisconsin voted in these last two presidential elections and you took all the states to the right of Wisconsin, they would not add up to an electoral majority of 270 electoral votes. And if you took all the states to the left of Wisconsin, they would not add up to an electoral majority of 270 votes. So both parties in a really close election absolutely needed Wisconsin to get an electoral majority. That's the tipping point state. It literally mathematically puts you over the top in the electoral college.
What about the level of importance? I mean, tipping point states are obviously crucial. Are they essentially, I mean, are they inherently more important than battleground
states?
Yeah,
I think it's really, again, it's less a measure of the closest state than it is mm-hmm. a measure of a state's strategic importance. It's really saying that if you have an election that's so close that it's decided by a single state, it turns out that's the state you needed under those circumstances. So it's probably the best. It's not the only battleground state, because there are going to be other states, you know, that have results that are very close, for example, to Wisconsin in these last two elections. But the way things worked out in both of these elections, it was an indispensable state. So I think it's primarily a measure of a state's strategic importance when it comes to the Electoral College.
Help us understand the calculation of the tipping point state, because we have the Electoral College that actually elects a president, but the calculation involves looking at the popular vote.
No, it's really looking at, we're just talking about electoral votes now. Mm. So obviously every state, the electoral votes that state casts is decided by the popular vote in that state. But, you know, you have states that are very red and states that are very blue. And those electoral votes obviously go to the candidate that wins those states. But you also have a bunch of states in the middle. And so in this case, the tipping point state is really kind of like the median state in the Electoral College. And it does mean in a close election, it's in all likelihood going to be very narrowly decided. Wisconsin was decided by less than a point in 2016 and in 2020, and of course going back to 2000 and 2004 as well. And in those elections, it was not the tipping point state, but it was very close to being the tipping point state in 2004, in 1992, and it was also the tipping point state in 1976. So that tells you that Wisconsin's strategic importance in presidential elections spans, you know, a half a century.
How is it that we are keeping this position when it comes to electing presidents? What is different about Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting question, because there's no one simple answer. I mean, if you pose that question about what makes a state a battleground state or what makes a state a purple state, you know, you think about it as a process of elimination. I mean, you've got a lot of states that are very red because of the regional political culture. I'm talking about the South and the Mountain West. You've got a lot of states that are very blue, again, for similar reasons. If you look at New England and you look at the West Coast, and then you have other states that, you know, all those states are off the table. They're not going to be battlegrounds. But what makes Wisconsin, I think, you know, on a short list of states that currently is a battleground, I think, you know, has to do with the mix of voters, the fact that you've got urban voters, rural voters, and suburban voters. One of the big kind of, you know, variants in presidential voting is how white voters vote. And you have a tremendous disparity between how white voters in the Deep South vote, which is overwhelmingly Republican, and how white voters in a state like Vermont vote, which is overwhelmingly Democratic. And again, if you look at these Great Lakes states like Wisconsin, white voters tend to be more mixed in their voting, and it's a more competitive voting group. So that is part of the explanation. What's kind of more perplexing in some ways is how a state like Wisconsin has managed to remain so competitive over, you know, different political eras when voting patterns and demographic voting patterns have changed a lot.
Craig Gilbert is a former national political reporter. Now he's a fellow at Marquette University Law School. We are talking about Wisconsin as a tipping point state in this pivotal role in presidential elections. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. How do you think about Wisconsin's role in the national political spectrum when you hear about this? Is it surprising to you that it has been in this position for so long? Or maybe that's exactly what you've seen, that Wisconsin always winds up being a focus of attention in the over these decades. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll go ahead and go to Jeff in Superior now, who's giving us a call to talk about this. Hey, Jeff.
Well, hello. Good afternoon. I really appreciate the opportunity to express my opinion on this topic because the Republican Party has chosen Milwaukee to be the venue for their convention next year. And I'm actually a member of the Douglas County GOP. But I don't think Wisconsin is the right venue for this type of presidential drama. With the indictments of Trump and all the conflict in the party, I think, in my opinion, that the GOP could have picked a better venue. And in fact, they may change the venue before the dates of the convention. The Democrats have chosen Chicago, and I think the Republicans would do better in Las Vegas or Arizona or somewhere where there's more enthusiasm and more, a majority of Republicans.
Thanks so much for that, Jeff. Craig, what do you think about Jeff's point when it comes to where these two major political parties are choosing to highlight their work and drum up support with their conventions?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question because parties have used different criteria to select their convention host cities. You know, stereotypically, we think of they're going to pick an absolute battleground. So, if you can imagine getting a little bit of a benefit from having a convention in a state that you really, really need, you see that pattern a lot. But you also see examples of, and in fact, the Democrats chose Wisconsin, for the convention 4 years ago that ended up happening in the pandemic. But we've also seen parties pick states for symbolic reasons, even states that they had no prayer of winning. I mean, the Republicans picked New York in 2004 because of the symbolism of New York post the 2001 attacks. Democrats picked L.A. in 2000. These are all conventions I covered when there was no way they were not going to win California. So there are logistical reasons, there are symbolic reasons, and then there is, if you think you're going to get even a fractional benefit out of having a convention in a given place, that's could be a reason, for picking a given state. I mean, the caller mentioned Las Vegas. That is another battleground state, as is Arizona. And the Democrats in this case picked what is not a battleground state. It's in a battleground region, Illinois, but obviously Illinois is a safe Democratic state.
We're talking with former political reporter and now fellow Craig Gilbert about Wisconsin's status as a tipping point state, a status that we have held on to for a long time. We're also talking about what it might look like in the 2024 presidential election and Wisconsin's place in this political cycle. We want to hear what you think by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of Wisconsin's role in the Electoral College? Do you think it still makes sense? What do you want to say about our processes and our place in them? Call 800-642-1234, or you can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. This conversation continues ahead here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about Wisconsin's unique role in the last two presidential elections and the likely role it will play in 2024. We are a tipping point state. Our guest is Craig Gilbert from Marquette University Law School, and we're taking calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Jillian in Superior on the line. Hi, Jillian.
Hi. I'm just wondering, you mentioned about the demographic for Wisconsin voters has changed pretty significantly over the last, I'm not sure how many years you mentioned. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on that more and how that impacts upcoming presidential election.
Thank you so much for the call, Jillian.
Yeah, I think,
Craig. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not so much that the demographics have changed, but the political demographics have changed, which in other words, the way different demographic groups vote has changed. And, one huge example is rural voting patterns. And I think most people who follow politics understand that, rural voters have become increasingly Republican in recent years. And Wisconsin was an example where Democrats were unusually competitive compared to other states with rural voters. Just as, suburban voters have gotten less Republican and more Democratic, and Wisconsin was once a state where Republicans did unusually well, with particularly with suburban voters in southeastern Wisconsin on the periphery of Milwaukee. Both those things have changed. And so the political map within Wisconsin has changed. The sort of formula geographically to winning the state has changed. But these changes haven't fundamentally advantaged either party over the other party. In other words, Wisconsin has remained competitive despite all these changes. I would say one of the bigger demographic changes, which is relevant to the state's politics in the last 20 years, is the growth of Dane County and the growth of Madison, the growth of the city of Madison, and particularly the growth of the suburbs of Madison. Madison being as blue as it is, that has really been a boost to the Democratic Party, and it's helped the Democratic Party overcome what has been the shift in rural Wisconsin, particularly in northern and western Wisconsin, toward the Republican Party.
Craig, Lisa from Winter called, couldn't stay with us, but Lisa says she's thinking gerrymandering has caused Wisconsin to kind of appear purple, when in reality, Lisa thinks it's really blue. What's your assessment there?
Well, I mean, gerrymandering obviously doesn't affect statewide elections. Mm-hmm. It affects legislative elections and congressional elections. So, and it has certainly produced, you know, a Republican lock, a one-sided Republican lock on the state legislature. You know, but she also raises the question of whether Wisconsin overall is a blue state or a purple state. And, you know, over the long stretch of time where I've been covering politics, in which Wisconsin has basically fundamentally been a purple state, there have always been times when some people thought Wisconsin was on its way to becoming either a blue-leaning state or a red-leaning state. And it's always sort of come back to being a purple state. And I think, if you look at the last 7 or 8 years since Donald Trump came on the scene, I think Democrats are doing better in statewide elections than they had done in the previous period of time. And Republicans are struggling. But you have to be careful about kind of extrapolating that out to future elections, because I've learned to be very cautious about projecting Wisconsin's sort of future political direction. But again, I think it's hard to make the case that Wisconsin is a, quote, blue state when 4 out of the last 6 presidential elections have been decided by less than a percentage point, including the last two.
That is particularly interesting because, you know, you point to Wisconsin being a tipping point in 2016 and in 2020, and we elected very different presidents in those elections, and somehow Wisconsin stayed in that pivotal role.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we helped put Donald Trump over the top in 2016 and then helped put Joe Biden over the top in 2020. So we were one of a limited number of states that voted for both Trump and Biden. We're also one of a very short list of states that are electing U.S. senators from different parties. So by all of these markers, you know, I think you have to sort of land on purple as the color, the political color of Wisconsin right now.
How many states are really in a place where they could be a tipping point state? I mean, Wisconsin is here in the middle, but most states, right, are reliably Democratic or reliably Republican in the presidential election.
I think you would say at a minimum, probably of the 50 states, you know, 42 or 43 of them are kind of locked in. And again, I'm talking about in a theoretical close election, not a landslide election for one party or the other. But I think, you know, all but about 7 or 8 states are pretty much baked in. You could even argue that really, you know, there's only about 4 or 5 states that are truly in play. I mean, you've got Wisconsin, you've got, if you go again, use the 2020 election as a guide, you've got Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. And so I think those would be on your list going into 2024. And then, you know, you could throw in Nevada, you could throw in North Carolina, you could throw in Michigan, although that's become a little bit more comfortable for Democrats, maybe New Hampshire, and that's about it. But again, it's a short list. It's kind of shocking, I think, to particularly to political observers outside the U.S. that we have these, you know, massively costly and consequential presidential elections, and you're really talking about a battle over a handful of states.
You're making me feel a lot of pressure here as a Wisconsinite, Craig, thinking that all of this rests with just a few states.
It really does. And, you know, we're probably going to be one of them. And when the states that are tipping the Electoral College one way or another are themselves decided by a few thousand votes or even 10,000 votes or 20,000 votes, which is, you know, which is nothing, then, you know, you're really talking about a pivotal state and a pivotal election. I think, you know, there is nothing, you know, predetermined about the way Wisconsin is going to vote in 2024.
Mm-hmm. We've got Karen in Cable who wants to join the conversation. Karen, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm thinking about how gerrymandered Wisconsin is, and that may not make a difference for a presidential race, but it certainly does for Senate races and congressional races, when even if you overwhelmingly have a majority who are voting Democrat, we still can't get a Democratic representative. And, you know, the same can be said in terms of the Electoral College out west. They have much more power with such small populations than they currently have a right to. We really need to consider popular vote versus electoral votes.
Karen, thank you for the call. Absolutely. Just pointing out that the Electoral College is not like the Senate. You don't get a set number based on the fact that you're a state. It is based on population. But when she speaks, Craig, it makes me think about the fact that we have a couple of callers now who seem to think that maybe Wisconsin appears purple because of the elected leaders we have in more local elections that are lots of Republicans, and then sometimes going Democratic in other ways. Is that anything that we can try to quantify?
Yeah, again, I think the only way to really evaluate, you know, the statewide partisan makeup of a state is to look at the biggest statewide elections. And we've talked about presidential races and how close they've been. We've talked about the fact that Wisconsin has alternately elected Democratic and Republican senators. It's one of, you know, very few states. I think we're down to maybe five or six that have one Democrat and one Republican serving in the U.S. Senate. And if you look at governor's races, we had, you know, Scott Walker winning. Well, if you want to go back in time, we had Tommy Thompson winning four races for governor in a row. We had, again, a Republican. We had Democrat Jim Doyle winning the next two races for governor after that. We had Republican Scott Walker winning the next three races after that, if you include the recall election. And now we've had Democrat Tony Evers winning the two races after that. So again, I'm going to sort of stand by my assessment that we're about as purple as you can get as a state. I would add on the question of the Electoral College, the caller does have a point in the sense that because every state's electoral votes are based mostly on population, but also every state is added to electoral votes for their senators, that does give small states a little bit of an extra voice in the Electoral College. On the other hand, while there are a lot of Republican small states, there are also some Democratic small states. So I think right now there is a Republican advantage structurally in the Electoral College, but that has just emerged in the last two elections. And that doesn't necessarily mean that in the next two elections, there's going to be the same Republican built-in advantage in the Electoral College.
Yes or no, Craig, is Wisconsin a tipping point in 2024?
Oh, yes. Well, there's only going to be one tipping point state. So whether it's Wisconsin or Arizona or Georgia or Pennsylvania could be just a matter of a fraction of a vote. But it's absolutely going to be one of the short number of states that matters and that will be bombarded by both campaigns.
We got a shot. Craig, thank you so much for joining us. Craig Gilbert talking about Wisconsin's position as a tipping point. This is Central Time.